the vault. High atop the pastoral center of the Diocese of Camden, you're listening to Talking Catholic.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Talking Catholic. I'm Jen Morrow, and with me as always is Mike Walsh.
Hi, how are you, Jen?
I'm good. How are you?
I am delightful. This is one of our Zoom episodes, which I know, you know, people sometimes complain about the audio, but that's okay, because we always make sure the content is really good. And I always enjoy when we get to do a Zoom with each other when we are quite literally 10 feet away and all of one story apart.
Exactly.
But happy Easter season. I always want to remind people that Easter is not a day, it's a season. And have a happy Easter season. I'm looking out my window right now, we actually have blue skies.
Which is surprising after a couple days of rain. So happy Easter season to you as well, Mr. Walsh. Did you have a good Easter? A good Easter?
I did have a good Easter, yeah. I got to see family. And actually, the Easter week was a very relaxed week around here. You know, it's the beauty of working for a diocese is that, Lent is a crazy 7 weeks. And then Holy Week gets just a wee bit crazier. And then Easter week rolls around and the priests leave town and everybody kind of goes into hibernation mode for a few days. So I enjoyed that. And then this week happened and everybody woke up again. So I had a very busy week this week, but that's okay. That's what keeps me employed. So I didn't mind. But you had a couple of great editions of the newspaper come out, including one that we've been getting rave reviews because our dear friend and fellow podcast host and writer for the Catholic Star Herald did an amazing story on the recently retired secretary for the Vicar for Clergy, who he did a wonderful job capturing her humanity and her joy. And it was really nice. So kudos to Pete Sanchez for doing a great story on her. And we're actually going to miss Susan quite a bit, but she's, if you get the opportunity, you should really, really read it.
Yep. That was the April 12th issue of the Catholic Star Herald. If listeners remember, Susan Petullo has been on the podcast before. So you could go back and listen to her while she was talking about her 43 years here at the diocese. I think she worked under five bishops, if I remember correctly. So it's just a great article, talking to her and then so many people that worked with her. It's a great send-off. And, I know Susan won't be a stranger around here. She's got too many friends and too much history. Speaking about Mr. Sanchez, Pete Sanchez also wrote a great article about a gentleman who just came into the Catholic Church. He worships at, I think, Christ the Redeemer in ATCO. Mm-hmm. And he was called to come into the church at the Easter Vigil after the birth of his daughter, who is now 10 months old. And that's just another really heartwarming story about, family inspiring faith. And it's a good read.
You know, we say that all the time, the Catholic faith, for the spiritual dynamic of it, is above reproach, obviously, but the community aspect is really what, I think sometimes falls to the side a little bit when we think about our faith. And I think that has a lot to do with the culture of today. We're all very siloed. We're very, unless it's a sporting event, it seems like we all go our separate ways, but the church is a community, and that sense of community, that sense of family, that's what speaks to people. That's what brings people together. So I hope people will read stories like that and think of the people in their lives and go, you know what, this person should be a member of our community. This person might have an interest. I was actually just talking to our Vicar General today about something similar. He's working on he's preparing for a wedding. And he's working with a young couple, and the groom is not Catholic. He's Episcopalian, but he has sort of an interesting backstory. I actually think it'd be a good story for Pete to do. I'd have to get people to sign off on it, but basically he grew up Episcopalian and the entire rest of his family converted to Catholicism, but he didn't because he was, you'll appreciate this, Jen, serving our country in the military. And he was out of the country when the entire rest of the family converted from Episcopalian to Catholic. And he just sort of became a de facto Catholic when he came back, but never actually converted. And so now he's getting married and they're working through the process and stuff like that. And he says it's been sort of wonderful to see this young guy who considers himself Catholic, but just wasn't able to go through the hoops, as he's working towards that progression. So it was beautiful.
That is a great story. That's a great story.
Yeah. We'll have to talk to him about that very soon. But it's another one. There are these stories in all of our parishes. You know, I'd love to be able to highlight all of them. I think it's a great thing for people to remember that I'm not sure that unless you go to the Easter Vigil Mass that it's at the forefront of your mind because you won't see it in the other masses. Right. But that's why I always tell people you should go to an Easter Vigil Mass because it's really a party. You know, it's a beautiful event. It's a beautiful celebration of the Mass. But then you get to welcome. You know, I think the biggest one I saw this year, so it was like 15 people coming in. It's like, that's a beautiful thing to see in the church is people coming in. So mm-hmm. I hope people will do that.
Agreed.
And did you, before we bring in our guests, did you two have a nice Easter season so far? I know you had a wonderful time in Germany on your vacation.
I did. I had a beautiful week in Bavaria, Germany, reuniting with some friends that we met 12 years ago when we were deployed overseas and with my husband. And they were friends who became fast family. And, you know, we keep in touch with them, but to see them in person again after 12 years, it was the personification of Easter joy to be reunited with them. And it was just like heart speaking to heart again. It was fantastic. And we lived in a very small town. So Easter morning, the church bells go off and we get up and walk to church, which was about, you know, a 1.5 minute walk. And so we got to spend Easter morning and the Catholic church in this small town called Euerbach. And it was really neat to spend Easter morning with in another language, like, you know, we do know some German, so we understood, and plus it's Catholic, so that's universal, so you understand a lot what's going on. But it was fascinating was the tabernacle in this church. You know, it's the tabernacle, obviously, because of the candle is lit. But if it hadn't been for that, I don't think I would have known right away, because it was basically a round stone. And it turns out, and that's their tabernacle all year round, obviously, not just Easter. So when it comes down in time to celebrate the Eucharist, you literally roll a stone to the side and inside is the Eucharist. And I thought that was quite beautiful.
Wow.
Yeah. I should show you some pictures. It was just beautiful. And then we spoke with some local Germans from after Mass in German and mainly German, my broken German. The other half is of me is much better in the German, but it was good. It was a good week. Like I said, a great way to usher in German joy too. Easter joy, the flowers are blooming. You know, you see the trees with all of the Easter eggs hanging off of them. It's usually the children in the town get together and hang eggs on the tree. So it's very beautiful.
Oh, that's wonderful. I was very happy to sort of follow you on social media and see all the fun you were having and your ridiculously handsome husband having a good time in Germany. And it also made me want to go back to Germany because I got to spend a week there not long ago, and I've been wanting to go back for some time. So I was a little jealous as well. But I got to talk to my boss about giving me a week off so I can go to Germany. So
there you
I got to go on that. There you go.
I know some great people you can visit.
Okay. I'll make that happen. All right. Well, that's enough about us.
That's right.
We have a great episode today, and it's a topic that we've hit on from time to time over the last couple of years. But when we talk about it, we always like to bring on people who are far smarter than us, particularly one name that is considerably smarter than us. And I know he's smarter than us because each of us have to edit his column once a week. And sometimes I really got to hit the dictionary. but he does great work, and it's one of my favorite columns in the Catholic Star Herald. So Jen, who do we have with us this week?
This week we have Michael Canaris, who is the Associate Professor of Theology at Loyola University, Chicago's Institute of Pastoral Studies. And of course, he's the longtime columnist for the Catholic Star Herald. Well, welcome back, Mike.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. You're too kind as usual.
As usual. Did you remember that, Walsh? Kind. Remember
what?
That I was called kind.
I know. Oh, I thought he was referring to me. sorry, that's weird.
Okay. And of course, we have a new guest I'm excited to introduce. We have Maureen O'Connell. She is an author and also the professor of Christian Ethics in the Department of Religion and Theology at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. Welcome, Maureen.
Hi, everybody. Greetings from West, far west Camden?
Far west? It does feel like that sometimes.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you all.
Well, we're happy to have you. And I don't want to put a pall on over anything too quickly, but as someone who grew up in this area and went to St. Joe's University, you know, we love you anyway, Maureen, so it's okay.
Well, I'm a fellow Hawk there with you, Walsh. So,
And I'm so happy, Maureen.
Uh-huh. It's all good.
I'm glad you've brought the essence of St. Joe's to the Christian Brothers over at LaSalle. We appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm trying, but you know what? They have a beautiful charism. It's been a really neat way of engaging in the diversity of our tradition, our Catholic tradition.
I love
tradition.
It.
Yeah.
That makes me very happy to hear. So thank you both for joining us. The topic we like to hit on every couple of months is the Synod, and Michael has been our resident expert that we bring back year after year. And the thing we really want to touch on, the fact is that the Synod is still going on. If you're not a Catholic watcher, you may not be aware of it. And, you know, we had the parish phase, we had the diocesan phase, we had the regional phase. And so it's sort of been an interesting couple of months. So Mike, my first question to you is, from your perspective, where are we in the synodal process?
Yeah, so the, you know, this ongoing, first let's say a bit about what synodality is, just to connect, you know, back and sort of draw the lens back a little bit. This word synod, it's literally means being together on the way. It's very connected to the Spanish words, caminando juntos, walking together. Pope Francis uses that all the time. And so he has said in a number of places, Pope Francis citing St. John Chrysostom in the early church, that the church and synod are synonymous, that they're related to one another. So what it means to be together on the way is what it means. You talked a bit about this in your opening comments there about community and relationship, that there is, of course, a vertical dimension to the faith that connects us with the transcendent God and the reality of truth across all ages and all generations, but then also something that connects us to one another, that love of God and love of neighbor are basically two sides of the same coin, deeply connected to one another. And so synodality continues to deepen our understanding of that in our day today. And so it's deeply tied, as you mentioned, St. Joe's. Maureen and I have overlapped at various academic stops, both at Boston College and Fordham, at various stages of our formation and teaching and journeys. And so this Ignatian piece. I'm teaching Intro to Ignatian Spirituality this semester in a graduate course. And so this Ignatian formation piece of Francis is an enormous element of this synodality project, because that idea of discerning how we're able to listen with both intention and attention to one another, that's the crucial element to synodality. So we're in the midst of this process, this ongoing process that really doesn't have a foregone conclusion at the end. You know, we're not moving towards some kind of a pre-approved stamp where this is where the synod process ends. I think there's a theologian named Paul Lakeland, and he has a book on Lumen Gentium, I believe, on the Second Vatican Council document. And the title is A Council That Will Never End, right? Because the ripples of the Second Vatican Council are moving, you know, echoing into our day, moving out into our day. And so I think that this project that we're in the middle of right now is in some ways a synod that will never end. What does the synod look like? What does synodality look like beyond our current moment? What does it mean to take some of these principles of proximity and listening and protagonismo, right? The sort of active engagement and dynamic agency of every person in the church. And what does it look like to integrate that into our life moving forward? So we're in the process of this. We're in media res, right? In the middle of things as we're unfolding this vision that we don't know what the future holds. It's very similar to a marriage. You know, you take those vows and you're saying yes as a promise for your whole life, and you don't know what that looks like. You don't know what the ups and downs are, what the challenges are, what the health and sickness are, what the child or not, that it's going to be blessed you someday is, but you step out into the dark with a promise of yes, right? The daring promise, to use Rick Velarde's title from another book. And so we're kind of engaged in that process right now, right? We're making this daring promise to the future of the church. And so we're in this as a community unfolding right now.
Maureen, I see you nodding a lot. What are some of your thoughts on that? What would you like to add to that?
Well, first, I'd like to take one of Professor Canaris's classes. He articulates,
me too.
I mean, he articulates some really, you know, complex and nuanced theological ideas, especially about church, in a really clear way. So like, I just deeply appreciate that, because that is really what's kind of unfolding with this synod. You know, synods are an ancient practice. In some ways, there's nothing new about synods. The Second Vatican Council encouraged a kind of return to that practice. And we saw, you know, that has been consistently happening. But I think what I find so compelling about this synod, and it's obviously not Francis's first synod either, he's convened a number of them. But I think it was the synod on the youth that really convinced him that we need a synod on what it means to be church, because he heard very clearly through the church's engagement with young people in that, you know, synod process, which wrapped in 2018, 2019, that they are really longing for a church that is defined by love and by encounter and by a sense of people really belonging to a communion of Christ, a body of Christ that's really trying to be alive in the world. That's the kind of community of faith that young people desire to be a part of. And so I think he was very inspired by them. And so this synod is about how do we be church together? And I, you know, I think it's very compelling to me that that invitation was not one that Francis only extended to the bishops, right? Because normally synods are an opportunity for the bishops to get together and be intentional and attentive, you know, as Mike was saying, to what's happening around particular issues in the church. This time, the Pope has asked all of us to be intentional and attentive. And that call to participate has really been very, granted, unevenly received across the church. But for the folks who have accepted that invitation, particularly the young adults that I've really been so blessed to be able to work with in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, anybody who has participated, has accepted that invitation, has found that process of really listening to what the Holy Spirit might be saying to us as individuals, and also in the lived experience of other people, to be a deeply faithful, faith-filled, energizing, hopeful, and in some instances, deeply consoling experience in and of itself is an experience of church that we're maybe trying to discern how to better become through this process.
Go ahead.
That's
Mike.
Something. Oh, I'm sorry. It's funny. So we've done a lot of reporting on the synod, and it's the people who have taken part have, to echo what you've said, have all come away with these wonderful experiences they've had. You know, whether or not. So we're done the diocese. We finished the diocesan phase, you know, a year ago, and then there was sort of a secondary diocesan phase that took place recently, where a number of questions came back to the diocese looking for answers, a very quick turnaround of answers, I might say. We had to have that done I think we've accomplished it in under a month, where we were able to sort of, you know, comment on these secondary questions that the Vatican put out. And each and every time we've done it, the people participated have come up with some really unique perspectives that, to both of your points, have already bore fruit within the diocese, unrelated to the synod. You know, we learned things during that process that we would have not learned otherwise had that synod process not existed. So whether or not from a global standpoint, you'll be able to measure the success of the synod, Michael, back to your point of those ripple effects, I can 100% confirm from a rank and file, from a in pew perspective, they have absolutely borne fruit. I don't know if that was the intention of the Holy Father when he came up with the synod, but if it was an unintentional consequence, then I think it was a positive unintentional consequence. And that depends, irrespective of where you fall on the Catholic spectrum. You know, in no way was it only people who were, I won't even classify them. it was across the board. So I personally have been very happy with it. And Jen might agree with this. It's made for great content, right, Jen?
Absolutely. Okay. It's great content. I find it very, you know, fascinating a lot for the reasons that both of you already spoke about. And I'm very interested in hearing what both of you have to say about, you know, the youth participation as well. I think it's fascinating that the young people are interested in this. I like a lot about what you were saying, Maureen, about, you know, they're longing for a church that is more like this. Can you dive into that a little bit and share what you've seen when it comes to that?
Sure. I mean, I think this time 2 years ago, we were at the beginning of that listening. Well, not even at the beginning, a couple, you know, months into the listening phase. And in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, there are, you know, I think at the time, maybe 11 institutions of Catholic higher education in the Archdiocese, and then obviously a number of Newman centers. And a small group of us said, well, what if we, you know, made sure that our college students knew that they were invited to participate and, you know, created a pathway for them to participate. And we collaborated with the diocese and trained people across all of these campuses to do listening sessions with students and to gather those fruits and then to bring them in with their bishops. We had a cross campus 2 years ago, a cross campus listening session with about 100 students and the Archbishop. And we, you know, we identified a number of themes that we heard, you know, we meaning some of the faculty and staff and campus ministers that accompany the students. And, you know, what we heard them saying is that they are looking for a church that is in journeying, wanting a church that's moving in towards different visions or hopes that they have. So, you know, some of those themes are wanting to, you know, move from a church of exclusion to a church of inclusion. Wanting to move from, you know, a church of where, you know, young people like them are being led toward a church where they are actually leaders, moving from a church of sort of performance to a church of authenticity. So they were clearly articulating a very strong desire to belong and to be accompanied and also to be affirmed for the gifts that they want to bring right now. And so one of our young adults, Archbishop Perez, allowed us in what we now, like our group, we call ourselves SHEEP, which is an acronym for Synodality in Catholic Higher Education in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. You can see why we landed on SHEEP, because that's a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah.
But the Archbishop invited us to nominate a student to go to the Continental Assembly between with the North Americans and the Canadians. So we did. We nominated this young woman this time a year ago. She was helping to kind of offer some feedback on the document that came out of that North American Continental Assembly. So this time last year, when Pope Francis said he would like, you know, for the first time in the history of the church, folks other than bishops to be contributing to a general assembly and asked for nominations, we were ready. And we nominated this young woman, and we had all of our student leaders sign and all of our campus leaders sign, and we sent it to the Archbishop, and he endorsed it and sent it to the Bishop's Conference, and they sent it to the North American Conference, who endorsed it, and it went to Pope Francis, and wouldn't you know it, he picked her. So Julia Oseka, a junior at St. Joe's University, is the youngest female voting delegate to a General Assembly ever in the history of the church. So to Walsh's point that, you know, we are already experiencing the fruits of this process before it's even finished. That process that we helped collaborate and create made the pathway for this young woman to be on the floor with those bishops, where she's advocating, having listened very carefully to her peers, advocating in those circles, in that assembly hall, where her voice is heard for the same amount of time as the cardinals in that space.
Wow.
And where her vote in the discernments counts the same amount. So, you know, I think for the young adults that we have engaged, that has been a very important affirmation that if they risk, and for many of them, it is a risk to engage in this process because they risk either exclusion or maybe some of them risk change to something that actually does provide them a sense of belonging and safety and comfort in a very challenging and anxiety riddled world, especially for our young adults. It says it's worth this risk because the global church is actually really listening to you, is actually in the language of some of those documents, making a preferential option for our young people. And so we've just found them to continue to step into their protagonism. So just, it's hard to believe it's maybe 3 weeks ago, maybe not even. We in Sheep ran a process here in the Archdiocese to invite anybody in the Archdiocese who wanted to weigh in on those questions that Walter was mentioning for this period. And, you know, we had students facilitating small groups. We had students offering their witness. And I think older generations seeing them and seeing them engaged just gave them so much hope. They're a source of hope for our church. So it's been a wild ride. And, you know, as Michael said, we don't know where it's going. And while that can create a little white knuckling, because some of us want to grip the steering wheel really tight, if we let go and recognize the Holy Spirit is at work and we trust the Spirit, especially as we approach Pentecost, it's taking us in some really places of abundance that I don't think we ever thought possible.
I think it's such a wonderful example, the students' experience about, you know, what they're looking for. Like you said, they want to be led to perhaps one day be leaders, but accompaniment, but also help foster the gift, their God-given gifts. And what better way than to be able to go and be part of that synod, and then for their peers to be able to see that and say, somebody is investing in our God-given gifts. Somebody sees that. Or as Mike Canaris said, listening, what did you say? Listening with intention and attention. That's beautiful. I love that. That's beautiful. Mike, what has your experience been with students in this process?
Yeah, so I mean, I am an ecclesiologist by training, so somebody who studies the church, right? So I deeply love the church. I mean, the idea that I'm here in Chicago, and which I love my university, and I love being sort of integrated in the life of the city. But, you know, if I had my druthers, I'd be home with Eagles season tickets, right? My family is back there. But the idea is, you know, friends here and everything. And but I've dedicated my life to the church. I think I am a loyal son of the church. But our love and loyalty to the church is always a result and a consequence of our encounter with God, not the reverse. It's not the prerequisite for our encounter with God. And so, you know, my work with students, I'm very blessed. I teach graduate students, so I don't, you know, they choose to be in there. They want to be studying material. It's a lot different than my colleagues who have to teach Intro to Theology 101 to people who, that's when you change hearts and minds, right? I have a different vocation on my end. But what we constantly talk about is the movement away from a propositional vision of the church. You know, my grandmother had a box of recipes, I remember, with index cards in a little square box. And so we have to move away from a vision of the church where we're pulling out these recipes from the box and saying, I believe in God, check. Father Almighty, check. Immaculate Conception, check. Assumption, check. And so at the end, it's all intellectual assent, and you get to heaven and you say, look, I checked all these boxes. You have to let me in now, right? And so a movement away from such a vision of the church as that, a movement that sees the importance of doctrine and teaching. We don't come to know Jesus Christ through magic or osmosis. We come to know him through our community. And so the community of the church has an indispensable role to play in this process. And so all of that is true. We need to go more deeply into our own understanding of the faith to understand the difference between Anselm, Augustine, and Aquinas. I laughed because on a student evaluation one time, they said, this guy talks about all the names have A's, Aquinas and Augustine. And so, but I mean, we need to understand the roots of our faith, but we also need to understand the limits of doctrine. The idea that no doctrine exhausts the meaning of our encounter with God. It's, you know it in your own life, right? The words love, the four letters, L-O-V-E, they can't get their arms wrapped all the way around all of the contours and messiness and transcendence of what that relationship embodies in your life, your love for your spouse, your love for your child, your love for your pet, whatever it might be. And so that's a human reality, and the words can't exhaust the meaning of it. Now we're going to transpose that to a transcendent reality with the incomprehensible, ineffable, absolutely mysterious God. That, you know, Augustine says, if you think you've comprehended something, what you've comprehended is not God. And so the idea of abandoning ourselves into that mystery by using the pointers of doctrine that allow us to enter more deeply into that mystery, but not to put all the emphasis into the propositions, and rather to situate them against this backdrop, very Rana, right? Ranarian vision, or Rana, against this infinite horizon of mystery. And so, I mean, that's what we're doing in this process as a church, that we're understanding, appreciating, valuing the doctrines, the clarity of the church, the role intergenerationally that the church has to play towards society, sometimes a prophetic role, sometimes an endorsing role, but yet it relativizes it in some ways, which is frightening for people, because that abandonment to the mysterious God who we cannot control, we can't put the Lion of Judah into a petting zoo somehow, I read somewhere, right? And so how do we live that as a people, not only as a person, as me, Mike Canaris, with all of my background, experiences, friendships, loves, but as a people, as a community, as the holy and faithful people of God, how are we doing that together that moves us beyond simply parroting the same teachings? I'll close with, as I've said it before in here, on this comment at least, that, you know, you can teach a parrot to say the words consubstantial with enough time and patience. You can get it to repeat it. It doesn't mean it's praying the creed, right? And so what does it mean to like appropriate and live at every aspect of our being these teachings of the church? It's much more than regurgitation and repeating.
Okay, I'm going to pause everyone just there. So I just make this completely unrelated comment. If you've ever wanted to have a conversation with Mike Canaris and you can't find him, just read his columns in the Catholic Star Herald, because he writes the exact same way he talks, and it is absolutely wonderful. And quite frankly, I'm even more shocked right now that you're able to put all that down in one shot without saying once. that was outstanding. And I'm this really is a promo for not this episode, but this right now is a promo to read Mike's columns, because they really are just that good.
And I say to my students all the time, I don't find myself a particularly good teacher, to be honest, right? So I feel like I sort of overcome my lack of preparation because I'm very busy with like sheer force of my personality sometimes. But I think there's a real skill set in being able to take deep theological conversations and make them accessible to wide swaths of the population. And I do think that I have a knack for that. I think because of the work with the Star Herald, to be perfectly frank, it changes the way you look at the world when you say, I got to write something this weekend on Sunday. Most of my articles I write on mute while I'm watching football.
Wow, you're better than me, Mike.
Oh my goodness, don't even.
but like you're seeing the world differently as you think about how can I share this with people, you know, bring them along with me into the conversations of live theological questions in academic settings and otherwise. And so I'm constantly trying to do that for the people of the Diocese of Camden, like in foster conversation in new ways that make sense to them, not simply talk at them or talk above their heads, but include them in this life of the mind that we're engaged in as academics.
I'm glad you say that, Mike, because you've been a columnist for us for a while, and I was very happy when our former managing editor Carl Peters brought you in, because that was what I wanted. You know, I the paper was a little different back then, and I felt that was missing. And when he was able to bring you in, I think it elevated the paper to something that does not appear in most diocesan level papers, and I really appreciate that. However, now that I know your process, I am now going to go back and see if I can do an analysis of all of your columns that took place during the NFL season, and which of them took place when the Eagles won, and which one of them were written when the Eagles lost, and see if there's a contextual difference at all. Was he angrier? Did the columns come forth as angrier after a loss?
I'm not right till like Wednesday when they lose on Sunday. Like Monday and Tuesday, they lost.
Well, thank you. Honestly, thank you for giving us a glimpse into your process. We really appreciate that.
I feel like if you can write that while still watching a football game, I have a lot of improvement to go, since I'm always like, all right, nobody talk to me. The door is being closed. I have to focus.
I also appreciate, you know, that, you know, Michael's attempt to sort of, you know, situate himself or articulate his vocation as a theologian, because I've been giving this a lot of thought as an ethicist. I'm trained as an ethicist. So the questions that you named about how do we become a people, right? Those are ethical questions. And I do think that at the heart of this synod is this invitation to become a people, especially in the United States, where we're now increasingly, both in our culture, but in our church, so incredibly polarized and so divided. If that is something, if that even just a fraction of that vision of becoming a people is possible, I think that that will really be a sign of an impactful and successful process for us in the United States. But I've been thinking about what it means for me as a theologian. Who are my people? Who am I accompanying as a theologian? Who am I thinking not for, but who am I thinking with, right? I think the synod is an invitation to everybody for conversion on all different levels. So like I, you know, I'm deeply appreciative of the way that Michael models that and offers that up, because that is serving the people of God, thinking with the people of God. I'm going to have to figure out what I need to have on mute in the backdrop. Maybe it'll be like House Hunters or something, which is the thing that I turn to when I just need to decompress a little bit. It's not Philadelphia sports, truth be told, but like, you know, but anyway, I really appreciate that way of thinking about how we're really all called to this work of becoming a people. And I think the questions that have come out of the synod, you know, that those questions came from the delegates, right? That included non-bishops for the first time. And that's, they're asking us, how do we become co-responsible in this work of becoming a people of God? It doesn't just happen. Communities are something that we make, that we're all responsible for making.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about how you two have been working together. I know you've known each other for a while, obviously running in the same circles. But I know that you're also a part of something called Centers, Catholic Education Network to Experience Roman Synodality, if I have that right. Yeah, there you go. Can you explain a little bit about what this is and, you know, how it started, where it's going? Maureen, you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, you can see like acronyms. I live in lots of acronyms. My husband's always like, between the acronyms and the charts in your life, there's a lot of creativity gets expressed that way. So really, this is an initiative that's very grassroots. It's growing out of a little grant that I helped apply for to bring some theologians, teaching theologians from different institutions around the country together to think about, well, what implications does synodality have for the way we teach? What implications does synodality have for the environments in our classroom? How are we using the spiritual practices of synodality, which are encounter, active listening, dialogue, and collective discernment? How are we bringing them into our classrooms? And so there was a small group that has journeyed together thinking those thoughts. I was fortunate enough to be in Rome last October for 1 week of the General Assembly, accompanying a group of students from Fordham University who were there as part of a course, and just kind of saw the way in which that being close, even being around the edges of the General Assembly there last October, really set those students on fire. One of them, in fact, was an MC of a national gathering that we had across higher ed with a handful of bishops and a bunch of students just last night. So it really is unleashing the protagonism of young people. So it was like, well, why couldn't we bring some other Catholic universities to Rome? And what if everybody kind of developed a course, perhaps, that they would be offering next fall that would be looking at things related to the synod in a variety of different, and from a variety of different angles in theology? So put out a call. Who would anybody want to do this? Anybody interested? And again, a number of folks said yes. And so we've just been journeying together to develop a bunch of different courses. We have about almost 15 institutions now that are participating. So we think that there'll probably be a delegation, a national delegation of about 100, mostly undergraduate students, but some graduate students, again, connected to courses. And, our hope is to bring young adults to Rome to witness to this experience, which in truth is I think as significant for our generation and maybe the generation immediately behind us, as Vatican II was. There's a big thing that's happening in our church. We're in the middle of it. So wanting our students to have some direct access to that. We also want to continue to form them in the spiritual practices of synodality, particularly as that might pertain to how they want to lead on their campus communities or in their parish communities so that they can be protagonists. And then we also want to develop their leadership. They have said, at least in Philly, they said, we don't want to be led, we want to lead. So we want to bring them together so that they can start to figure out, well, how do they want to lead? What would they need from us as their educators, as us as ministers who accompany them in terms of leadership? So it's the hope that we go for a week and we're together for a week in Rome and experience a lot of different things together, do some education together. We're putting together a request for a papal audience, which would be amazing. So I don't know who the patron saint of papal audiences might be. I don't know who we need to start, who we light the candle for. But yeah, we're just hoping that we give this next generation of folks a really profound experience, that they are part of a church that seeks their gifts, seeks their visions, seeks their dreams, wants to journey with them, wants to make a preferential option for them. And hopefully that's going to change us as educators. Hopefully that's going to help our universities be part of this process of becoming a synodal church, which is going to be a long project. We don't know the end. It's going to be a long project. And I don't know, we're going to rely on Michael's really well-vetted list of great Italian restaurants all over Rome to enjoy some good company with one another, because we don't tend to collaborate that much in higher education. Believe it or not, we compete with one another. So the opportunity to collaborate deeply like this across these institutions, I'm collaborating with colleagues and designing educational experiences. It's so much fun. So
we're working together to create coursework for courses, but also the group that will be going to Rome would be a mix of educators and students. Do I have that correct?
You do. Yeah. So again, it will be, so the folks, there's a nice cohort of us from Philadelphia. And the cool thing about the folks in Philly is that we're all teaching the same course and collaborating on designing the same course, which again has never happened in the history of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, that you can have four institutions of higher ed with four different faculty designing a course that's going to be offered on these four different campuses in a collaborative way. So if again, we're looking for fruits of synodality, this collaboration as opposed to competition, this becoming a people in the context of higher education in Philly has been fantastic. So there's a number of us from Philadelphia. We've got Loyola Chicago. We've got the University of San Francisco. We've got the Catholic Theological Union. We've got Georgetown. St. John's is in the mix of trying to get there in Queens, trying to get, join us, get some details worked out. I'm trying to think of some of the other institutions that are coming with us. It's just a really nice broad array. Fordham, yep. Loyola, New Orleans. It's really fascinating. And again, I think what's going to be neat is the work of collaborating together as educators on a project like this doesn't often happen in higher education. So we're all bringing our distinct gifts, right? Michael's not just bringing the gift of his list of restaurants, right? He's bringing the gift of having taught. He's already done this online. Maybe you can say something about this. Taught online, an international course, right? That we're bringing down the walls of higher education and collaborating. And that's forming us in a different way. It's forming us to be in the church in a different way, which is super exciting. I don't know what you think, Michael.
Yeah, two things on that. So on that collaborative piece, that we offered an online class last year now, it feels like it was just yesterday, but where we had students from Chicago studying with students in Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, and Guatemala. So I had 92 students in the class from all those places, a bilingual class, and we had we structured it kind of synodally, trying to not teach only about synodality, but to proceed synodally. And so we would have large group sessions every other week where you would have like a great speaker from the Vatican or someone come and speak to the group. And then the students were broken down into small group sessions, small group pods, we called them, mixed between universities. And then in that area, that was exactly where we were trying to grow these talents and skill sets that Maureen talked about students, like, you know, not this idea of being the voice for the voiceless. You know, everyone has a voice. So what we saw ourselves as is voice coaches, trying to unmuzzle voices that have not been listened to for a long time and why. And so the students were taking active leadership roles in these small group sessions, kind of studded every other week with the large group things. Because that large group thing can be a little bit passive, right? You get a great speaker, you talk for an hour, you ask two or three questions, and then you wrap. That was really different than what was going on in a small group. So that's one piece of it. The separate piece kind of focused on this Rome thing, you know, just as Catholics, it is the beating heart of the faith. Now, a global church, it's not, you know, it's a unique sociological world there that is quite Italian in its formulation. You know, what would the Curia look like if it was situated in Nairobi or in Madrid or in Latin America somewhere? It would look very different, probably. But because we're working within the system where, you know, Peter and Paul were martyred there, it has a special significance for the Catholic Church. But the idea is not just to go there and have the students talk to one another or get great content from professors, but really to put them in thought partner relationships, dialogues with all of the great stuff that is unfolding there. So, I mean, things like the Sant'Egidio community. I'm working now both with the Pontifical Commission for Latin America and doing some other work with the Dicastery for Culture and Education. So the voice is there. The Israeli Embassy to the Holy See, they're going to welcome my group because I take my own class separate from this in May, and then this inter-university project is in October. So we're going to meet with the Israeli Ambassador to the Holy See, just emailed me this morning. Centro Pro Unione, the ecumenical hubs, the lay center, you know, the kind of network think tank of sort of lay spirituality in the global church. So putting the students in conversations with all of these different elements that are unfolding sort of around the synod. It makes me think a lot about the council, the Second Vatican Council, obviously, right? So on one end of the council, you had the documents that are produced at the end, but they're never inextricable, is that the word? They're never removable from the event of the council. So when you had all of these thinkers that were watching soccer at night and getting coffee together and the non-Catholic observers to the Second Vatican Council who were meeting and offering feedback that was then working its way through the theological experts and the bishops into the documents. Or if you know anything about the Catacombs Pact, I mean, if you don't know anything about that, Google it. It's unbelievable. But you had, at the end of the council, you have these bishops from Latin America. That it's almost like a Dan Brown novel. They go into the catacomb and in a mass down there, they pledge to renounce worldly esteem and honor and privileges and live in solidarity with the 2/3 of the human race who are struggling for dignity. I mean, it's a beautiful thing, but it's not part of the technical documents of the council, but it's part of the event of the council. And so what we're trying to do here is get the students and the professors and the campus ministers and everyone else that's part of this project to come with us to be part of the event of the synod, even if they're not voting delegates. And the way I'm structuring my own class, I do have a graduate class going because I only teach grad students. But the way I'm doing it is I don't want the students to think, all right, he's teaching a class in ecclesiology. 20 of the students in there get to take a boring class, academic class with Professor Canaris, and his four favorites get to go to Rome with him. That's not at all how that's going to be horrible. If you try to structure a class like that, it will collapse. So the way that I'm structuring it is we're all going on this process together. So they're going to offer insights and feedback into texts and ideas, and then almost like have some ambassadors from the class go represent their voices to this community. And then when they come back, unpack and debrief that experience. So the whole group is coming with us on this journey. And so that it's not, trying to broaden and stretch out that idea of whose voices can be heard, whose voices are a part of this process. And so, again, trying to get us to integrate and orbit around and intersect with the idea of the event of the synod in powerful ways. I mean, it's so exciting to be invited to participate in a project like this.
And hearing both of you speak is just another reminder. You know, we've all heard so much talk about the synod, both for and against, or this is just, if you ask, in my opinion, a result of the synod that was unseen. Right. Like, especially if you're thinking, oh, well, they just want to change the church, or when it comes to naysayers. But this has nothing to do with what's actually going to come out of the document. This is what has spurred from the synod, which is a collaboration, like you said, Maureen, on a level that's not often seen with you working so many universities working together. Or like you said, Mike, the idea that you're not your favorite student gets to go. No, this is the ambassador who will come back. And to me, that's just a beauty of the synod that the Holy Spirit must have been involved in to see these unforeseen morsels of love, I guess, however you want to say it.
I like morsels of love. Morsels of love work.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I would agree. And at the same time, though, I do think that much of what's being discerned in the synod is on the table because lots of people of God participated in articulating what they saw as sort of the biggest obstacles to journeying with the church and the biggest dreams joys, deepening the joys of journeying with the church. So there are some things that are on the table that are being discerned that are very significant to the young people who we accompany. And so for many of them, and I think, you know, part of why we want to bring them to Rome is to give folks in the room and in those spaces some courage to really be both intentional, coming back to Mike's ideas, intentional and attentive to the way in which what they are discerning is going to impact the young people who have said, we're not the future of the church, we are the now, you know, of the church. So I think part of at least my hope is, you know, to just sort of help some of those delegates who might not have ongoing direct encounters and experiences with young adults to perhaps offer that as an opportunity. In addition to just providing the support to the two U.S. college students who are voting delegates and carrying an awful lot of responsibility in making sure that like really critical things do get thoroughly discerned and talked about in this process, that we become a people even more, more deeply connected to one another, having weighed into some of the tensions that have been named through this process, not necessarily running from them. So, and we don't know what the outcomes of those things are going to be. So again, to be close to that kind of uncertainty and that sense of deep hope in the Holy Spirit, I think will be very important too.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. This was as good a podcast as I could have hoped for, and you guys delivered beautifully. So thank you for that. And I hope our listeners really get something out of it because, you know, the synod's a long process and it ebbs and flows. So, for some folks, some listeners, it might have been on the back burner, but it's good to remind them that it's very much on the front burner, and we've already seen a lot of positive ramifications of the synod. So thank you for that. Maureen, you're welcome on the podcast anytime. Feel free. And if you'd ever like to, you know, compete with Mike as a columnist, you're all, we are always open to receiving columns. So
oh, that's
if you're
cool. Interested, yeah. I need to become a subscriber. So yeah. Your subscription list just went up by one. Yeah.
That we like to hear. All right. Well, thank you to our listeners. Thank you to all of you, Jen. Thank you very much for putting this together. And we will talk to everybody again next week. See everyone.